You're listening to Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, a podcast that explores the world of K-12 education as it intersects with the Christian faith. You might call us extreme moderates. We're skeptics who try not to be cynics and are allergic to cheap rhetoric. Welcome to the show. Welcome back. I was going to say, here we are, another episode, but I say that every time.
We were just chatting about that in the pre-recording session here, Riley. We're setting up the microphones, and that's what you said. It's like, I got to think of something new.
Yeah, I said, welcome back, which was your suggestion.
So there you go. I gave you that one. Off air, you took it again, but I fully wanted you to take that one.
Because we're still learning this, if we're totally lifelong learning, right?
Yeah. Learning how to do podcasts.
And we're alone this week. It's just us.
No interviewees. No. Yeah, we've had some good people across the table the last couple of episodes.
So I think it's time that we maybe put you on the spotlight.
Yeah, this would be a good chance to maybe unpack a few things that I've been thinking about. And hopefully in a future episode, we get to do the same for you, Riley.
I actually have nothing to say. I just watched the volume levels and feed questions.
Oh, I think not, but all good.
So just to get in, we know that you're a humanities teacher and a history buff, but could you explain by what that means? Not all high schools necessarily have humanities as a core subject, but what do you mean when you are a humanities teacher?
Humanities is just a fancier word for what I actually do, which is social studies and history in particular. But I love that we use the language of humanities. We're actually, to be totally honest, we're moving away from that language. We've sort of divided our department up. But I love the notion that we're dealing with the human condition. We're dealing with what does it mean to be human? These are ultimate questions. They're big questions. They lead to questions of ultimate significance around how the world ought to be, how humans ought to function.
I get it now. It's like that root word in humanities literally is human. That's a fun take on it. Well, so, not a take. I guess that's literally just what it is. But for me, it's a fresh view of the word.
Well, it obviously was new for the person who decided to label the doors in our high school. I don't know if you've been down the hallway from here, Riley, but we have a book room.
Yes.
It's the humanity book room. And I say that with a singular, humanity with a Y, because that's actually how it's spelt on the door. It says humanity room, singular. All of humanity is in
the
this room.
The humanity book room. Oh, the humanity.
I've even received mail. I was formerly the head of our department. We sort of shifted some things around. And I got a letter put in my mailbox one time, and it said, again, singular, I don't know what's going on, head of humanity. So if I had business cards, I would label the head of humanity. Actually, my Facebook little bio says I'm the head of all humanity at the school we teach at.
Oh, that's so rich. Head of humanity. Oh, days. So you are a history teacher, a history buff, and you are passionate about, well, and I'm curious, this phrase, did you coin this phrase? It's historical thinking as faith formation.
I'd like to take credit for putting those words together. I'm actually borrowing a formula. I've heard it in different contexts where you're really playing around with the preposition that's between there, the word as. Mm. So we have historical thinking, which I can talk about, and we have faith formation. This is what we're talking about in our Faith and Learning podcast. And I'm using the as to link them, that actually it is through the process of thinking historically, whether that's in a history class or not, but it's that thinking process itself becomes formative in our Christian faith.
And you wouldn't say that it's historical thinking is faith formation. It's as faith formation or vice versa. Faith formation is historical thinking, right? It's just a form of it.
It's a form of, absolutely. And it really is an attempt to get at this integrative language, like where we are actually experiencing development, or what we are calling formation. We're being formed in our Christian faith, even as we are in a history class, even as we are doing the often challenging work of thinking historically, by which I mean thinking about causation and consequence, thinking about issues of historical significance. Why are we even talking about this issue or this person or this controversy? Thinking about other historical thinking concepts of change over time versus continuity. All of these, of course, are very common in a lot of historical pedagogy, a lot of strategies. It certainly is the foundation here. We're in British Columbia. And out of the University of British Columbia, the Historical Thinking Consortium, as it's called.
Critical Thinking Consortium.
Yes.
The Historical Thinking section of the...
Are they linked? I didn't realize they were...
TC squared? Yeah. Critical Thinking
This is
consortium.
Connected to... So we'll link all of these things up. Mm-hmm. There's the as for you, right? The preposition. These things are actually linked. I was not aware of that. But it's sort of an in-house thing here in province that has been adopted not only in our provincial curriculum, it's been adopted by the International Baccalaureate, the IB, also uses these. So what I started discovering, here's tools that are used in any school you're at. If you're taking social studies or history in any school in British Columbia or IB, you are using this historical thinking model. And I started to think about, well, does this have any currency for faith formation? Does this have any currency for developing as followers of Christ? And it's not, I don't have to, as we've said before, I don't have to slap a Bible verse or sanitize something or Christianize it to make it relevant for faith development.
Bible-based platitudes, I think, is what you've said in the past.
Is that my own quote? Sure.
Yeah. well... for me, I find this fascinating because these strands of historical thinking, is that what they're called? What are they? Stems?
They're concepts.
Concepts. Okay, concepts of historical thinking are, they begin in grade six, which is when I start teaching social studies. It's what I teach. So I find it fascinating that at similar levels or at different levels, we're teaching similar concepts. So for me, I'm really interested in learning more about what that looks like as faith formation in my classroom as well. Now, here's a contextual phrase that we are familiar with, and people maybe in the lower mainland of British Columbia, the evangelical lower mainland of British Columbia might be familiar with, or anyone that listens to Hillsong circa, 2003, But that term, history maker, it was a popular song, I think, by Hillsong.
It's actually Delirious.
Delirious, yeah. Of course. Delirious question mark. Or is it Delirious exclamation mark?
I think it's question mark. Yeah, I'm really showing, you're showing your age and I'm showing my age when it's like, no, this is a Delirious song. I remember it. It's late 90s,
I
believe. You're looking it up now. Fact check.
Young. Okay, here we go. Delirious history maker. Delirious, it's the question mark. See, that was so interesting. Like, how do you pronounce that? Hey, have you heard the latest Delirious album?
That's before your time, man.
I just find it too funny. And it was
1999.
Yeah.
I was in high school.
Oh, cool.
There you go. So, sorry, you were asking, so history maker.
Well, I was just kind of prefacing this phrase because, well, the song was obviously popular in evangelical circles, and it was, I don't know when this happened, but it was coined as a phrase for a youth conference that would take place annually, in our area. I remember when I was growing up in youth groups, people would say, oh, we're going to History Maker or History Makers this weekend, yada, yada, yada. I actually never attended. But it really was a popular event, and you have had some experience with this. But I would love it if you could address the term history maker. As a history teacher, what are your thoughts on this?
When I hear the term history maker, I am naturally drawn towards where it places the emphasis in terms of agency, of you as the individual, you individual Christian, are going to change the course of history. And it's lofty, it's aspirational, it sounds really good. And yes, as a matter of fact, you can make a whole conference out of it. And before I sort of deconstruct the term a little bit, I was actually invited to the conference. I've been sort of railing against this language of, do you really have the agency to change the world? Are you going to be a world changer? And sort of a thinly veiled critique of this conference movement. It was only fair that I would go to this event back, I think it was held last spring, and I was moved by what I observed and heard there. I mean, there's some critique. We've had some conversation about sort of the worship industrial complex that has sort of consumed evangelicalism. But all of that aside, I think it actually is about religious rhetoric in our subculture that tends to fashion the identity of Christian students as so-called world changers. We use that language all the time. You're going to change the world. And so when I came across this local Christian conference that promotes itself as history maker, it got me thinking a little bit that I think in our zeal, and I use that word quite intentionally, we're full of zeal and passion. In our zeal to change the world, we might be unintentionally short-circuiting the patient work that is character formation. It's not that simple. Again, I referenced before, and I'll do it again, Sarah Bessie, local author.
Yes, I was going to maybe go there, yeah.
Yeah, in her book, Out of Sorts, one of the chapters is actually called The Evangelical Hero Complex. The hero complex, that we need to do great things for God. And underneath that, I get the sentiment it's good, but underneath that, there is actually a denigration or downplaying of the mundane and the ordinary, where I think God is actually at work most of the time. And I think that our student ministry emphases in this, in the context of a Christian school, is going to be chapel. It's going to be in, we call it Christian perspectives, but it's really our theology. It's our Bible curriculum here. I think that emphasis on changing the world actually betrays, if I can be so strong, it betrays an understanding of historical significance, back to historical thinking, and of individual agency within human affairs. That's what we talk about in history. I think that's actually at cross purposes with good historical thinking pedagogy. Like, if I can be so blunt, we're shooting ourselves in the foot when I am teaching good historical thinking pedagogy, historical thinking, and then we trot off to chapel or we promote these events or we use rhetoric. And this happens in all places, but none the least, being in a Christian context, to speak to our graduates as being those who are going to make history, that they're going to change the world.
What the heck is that?
I don't know.
Our listeners can hear. There's someone hammering above us or
tapping something. Away. Which is odd. It's a math class directly above us. So we're in our partitioned, compartmentalized world. We're sitting in a social studies class on the ground floor, and
there would neither be noise nor fun in a math class. So what is going on up there? Just kidding. Sorry, that just is stereotypical and awful. I rescind all my comments.
Sometimes students find it jarring when I suggest that they are relatively insignificant in the grand scheme of history, which is what I do often, Riley, when in class.
Do you go up person by person?
And you don't them? Actually matter. You're not that significant.
You're totally depraved.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, yeah. Getting into, we could theologize that a little bit. But no, I mean, it's almost like a pendulum swing. Back, I think it's like a bit of a course correction. The school we teach at, Riley, I mean, it's almost like we're dropping hints every week, little by little, people trying to piece this together. We are in a suburban, upper middle class, relatively affluent context. And for me to guide students to conceive of what the historical thinking model calls significance, I actually do it by way of historical insignificance, right? Most of the students in our culture, it's a striving culture, they're bound for the types of post-secondary training that will initiate them into the professional class in society. Like, that's where so many of our students are headed. And it's wonderful. It's actually quite exhilarating to be with students on that journey. I love what we do, and God is at work here. But expectations around academic achievement for our so-called clientele, this can be all consuming. And then what happens Riley, is you add on top of that expectation, that's a very high academic expectation, we add this religious rhetoric of I'm going to change the world. And I think students find it jarring when I suggest that they're actually relatively insignificant in the grand scheme of history. A definition of historical consciousness is put forward by the historian John Lewis Gaddis. I'll put his, we'll put it online, his book called The Landscape of History. He basically says this, to be historically conscious is actually maturity by the way of relative insignificance. It's recognizing that in the grand scheme of things, you actually don't matter that much, and you project that through time. So Professor Gaddis, he likens it to the progression from childhood and adolescence to adulthood, which is kind of interesting because you're midway in that process in grade six, and I'm a little further along in that adolescence to adulthood transition in grade 12. And it's in that progression where there is usually increased awareness that, you know, the world doesn't revolve around oneself. Despite the fact that, you know, this phrase, you actually aren't that significant, I think that would actually fail as a valedictorian address. I would not be asked to give a valedictorian address that you actually don't matter. It's not, you're not that significant.
That's one of the ones where like the mic would get plugged or pulled.
They'd pull you away.
Yeah. Or something like that. Yeah. Those are some, there's some good YouTubes of that.
I love those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're great.
I actually skew towards toward a little more towards the realism in history class. I view it as an antidote to a certain kind of private school hubris, if I could call it that. I mean, God forbid, in a Christian private school. I mean, I think we do it unintentionally. I don't think we mean to be exalting students to the stature of world changers. I think we do it, we come by it honestly, but I don't think it's helpful.
Do you think that this is in any way related to how we sometimes go to students and just tell them that they're great? You know what I mean? Like how I'm trying to center it around something that I've heard, but praise, you know what I mean? Like praise time and time again.
Affirming, affirmation.
Yeah, affirmation. And it's kind of this spiritual affirmation where it's like, well, I've been told my whole life that I'm a history maker. How are you telling me now that I'm not? Which explains the jarring nature of their feelings.
I think it's a long view. I think in the moment, there need absolutely affirmation and different strategies for couching sort of like constructive criticism, not just of, I mean, it's going to be about students' work and their achievement, their performance, as opposed to their actual inherent worth or value. We want to separate that out, right? I learned from another colleague, can I say he's your dad? Are we giving too
Absolutely.
Much away?
No.
Yeah, your dad teaches here and he's been a wonderful, wonderful mentor to me.
He needs to be on the show soon.
I think so. So we'll jot that down. We need to get Duick Sr. on here.
Duick Sr.
He's.
What did he tell you?
What did he tell me? He gave me this phrase. He tells students all the time, you are more than your mark. You are not defined entirely by a number. And as simple as that sounds, students need to hear that. So in the humanities department, whether it's social studies or history, we wrestle all the time with the apparent tension between the intrinsic value of a human life created and loved by God and the infinitesimal position of that same human life within time and space. This is that you matter greatly to God, you're of infinite value, and you are also just, you know, this speck of dust in the universe that doesn't actually really matter in the grand scheme of things. What are mere mortals that you should think of them, the psalmist writes, human beings that you should care for them? As a class, we often explore stories within the biblical narrative, and so many of these stories point to a kingdom, which is the kingdom of God. Right, the kingdom that Jesus is proclaiming and bringing forth on the earth. So many of the ways that Jesus measures things, I would call them metrics, the way he would measure significance, read the parables, read the Sermon on the Mount, all of these things, they rarely align. They hardly ever align with what we would call political influence, what we would call social standing or status, what we would consider to be economic and imperial power and might. I mean, all of these things are things that we study in history class semester after semester, and students are learning all of these things, and they rarely overlap, or it's this jarring disconnect, right? And I think for us to reflect on this as a paradox, I would call it a par- like it's a seeming contradiction.
Yeah, jarring juxtaposition.
It's jarring. I think if we live in that tension, if we live in that paradox, it can help guide us to what I hope we could call historical thinking as faith formation. I think it's going to form our faith by grappling with this at a level that seems almost like paradox, that it doesn't fit.
That is fascinating. That is truly fascinating. Now, in our context, historical thinking has a number of different concepts. And what? So let me just go through them quickly. You don't address all of them necessarily. Well, and actually, we forgot to mention, but that this is from a lot of these ideas were culminated in a paper that you presented at Calvin College just last year, was it not?
That's right. It was just last fall. I was actually at a conference hosted by an organization called the Conference on Faith and History. And they're a lovely organization that deals mostly with post-secondaries. They're mostly university-level material. They have reached out in the last year and are looking at K-12 education. And they really want to appeal specifically to secondary school teachers. That's how I got sort of involved in what they're doing. I am a member of that organization. And I wrote a paper on this and got to share it. And I actually, in that one, I did name the school we're at. Right? But and my name tag had the school name on it, but we'll leave that to mystery.
Yeah, Google it if you really care. Who cares? Anyways, but these concepts that we have, and you address some of them in the paper, and you've already talked about some of them, but how many are there?
Yeah, the historical thinking concept model bases it on six, and it's historical significance, continuity, change, cause, consequence, and the ethical dimension in history.
So, and you address historical significance. You've already started to talk about that with History Maker. And you also address in the paper cause and consequence. So how about you...
Continuity and change.
Continuity and change. So how about you take
a moment right?
Yeah. How about you take a moment to share about how faith formation and continuity and change can intersect?
Well, the learning standards of any good history course require that we analyze narratives, stories over time that look at progress and decline. We talk about that, about empires, about nations, about organizations, or even individuals sometimes. We also do something called periodization, which is just a fancy way of saying we carve up history into different time periods, like eras, or if you've ever heard compartmentalize history into decades, like describing the 60s or the 1970s or the 80s. That's an example of periodization. We also talk about how these forces shape both the individual and then they shape like communities that we're a part of. So how might an understanding of these concepts, you're asking about measuring things that change over time, you're measuring things that stay the same over long periods of time, like what on earth does this have to do with faith formation in a student? I think that rather than attempting to shoehorn Christian practices into the classroom, we've talked about this before where we slap Bible verses, or we choose examples that we think might be, you know, pious.
Or we have word problems that have to do with Christian bookstores.
Exactly. We want to get beyond that. And so I think rather than doing that, we explore how historical thinking actually has sort of these formative qualities built into it. For one example, would be how we tell time. How do we inhabit space, which we talked about a little in an earlier episode. I think it was episode two. Episode two, we talked about liturgical time and the liturgical calendar. That has tremendous currency in my history class. I don't have to go through. I mean, if I'm teaching Bible, I would unpack, you know, the significance perhaps of Advent or of Easter or whatever one I'm talking about. But I think by doing this, I would call it an overlay, right, of sacred time onto secular time. Time in the world, which is what history class deals with. If you're taking an ancient history class, if you're taking modern history, you're studying a certain era, all of these, I think it can activate historical thinking, even as it's informing Christian identity.
Now, in a previous episode, episode 4, we had an opportunity to talk about evangelical music and worship music specifically, and you are doing some interesting things in the IB Humanities department of the school that we teach at. And I have a feeling that it is in some way rooted as well to historical thinking. So I was hoping maybe you could share a little bit about what's going on there.
So rather than just thinking about ideas, sometimes it's helpful to enact or to actually have practices that we do. And one of the things we've started doing is starting our week and ending our week by walking over to our chapel. So Christian school, we have this chapel building and it sits empty for most of the week. I know it gets used for other things. We have our actual chapel services in there, but I actually gather our history class around a piano and we sing. Sometimes we sing some contemporary tunes that students will know. I mean, these are like, we call them heart songs. And then I'll appeal back to some music that comes from our own traditions that maybe students aren't familiar with. And I have a whole rubric for how I might decide what we should sing. For example, emphasizing more scripture, or I do love a lot of music that doesn't use personal pronouns, that actually is corporate or collective, like sings about we collectively, or is actually about, you know, fancy this. We talk about God, we sing about God. But I find that within the contemporary evangelical movement, so much of our worship music, it emphasizes change. It actually privileges it. It's all about the new. We constantly sing new music. I would actually, to use historical thinking terms, suggest that it's actually a discontinuity. It is actually privileging change. It's discontinuity with older church music. It's a discontinuity with older church music. Now, my attempt is actually to connect us with like believing communities in the past. I should be very careful here, Riley, to say this is not actually like driven by like nostalgia, like this emotional, like, oh, like if only we could go back, like music was so good back in the day and it kind of sucks now. Like that's not what I'm going for. That sort of feeds into the worship wars that sometimes happens where it's like, well, I like this style and no, I prefer that style, or let's just sing hymns. That's not really what I'm getting at. I'm really getting at this idea of music from previous generations. It connects us both to God and to the social and political realities of Christian believers who came before us. Is that not a wonderful entranceway? Is that not like a portal into good historical thinking? And that's one of the things that I've been able to do.
And the student response, what's that been? Because you've continued it.
So a student review, a common student review has been, when are we going to sing again? Because sometimes we skip a week or two just by the schedule. We're not perfect. And to hear students actually, one, to hear them requesting that we go back over to the chapel to do what we call our invocation or our benediction, little tiny service, or to hear them actually humming the tunes. This is the other thing. I mean, one of my other criteria is let's have tunes that are actually like singable and that get in our heads. So to hear students humming them and singing them, they become part of the rhythm of, it becomes the soundtrack of teaching history. And that students would be singing them is wonderful, a wonderful way to start the week and through the week and then end the week.
This has truly been very fascinating, and just thinking, because the BC curriculum really does embrace these historical thinking concepts from grade 6 all the way to grade 12. So I'm really trying to think about how this can be meaningful for me in my social studies class, which is just fascinating. My question for you is that if other people are interested in finding more about this historical thinking, faith formation, where could they go?
Well, as we were just yakking behind the recording time here, I did write a paper on this, and I would be happy to share it with anybody who is interested in just exploring this, not just more academically. I mean, I'm citing some different sources. There's some people that I've not mentioned here that have been very influential. But if it would be helpful for people to see how I've connected these two things and how it's played out in my classroom, I expand on some of the examples. The paper is called Historical Thinking as Faith Formation in the High School History Classroom. And yeah, I would love to share it up. So I would be happy to send it to anybody who requested it.
And how could they get a hold of you?
So I'm on Twitter My personal Twitter is at Mr. McF, Mr. MCF Teaches. And if you are following us on at Not Many of You, you'll see that I constantly am retweeting, and you can find me linked up there. And you could shoot me a text and shoot me a message. I would be happy to send you the file.
This is a brand new segment of the show that really only happens maybe twice a year, I guess. And it's really just for Dave, because I work on a linear semester. Well, it's not even a semester, but a linear scale. But we're at the turn of the semester. Speaking about what time it is, it's semester change time. And with semester change time comes course evaluations. So bringing out the new segment of the show called Course Evaluations. Dave, hit us up. What do you got?
This has to be the best endorsement of my course and the material that I have gone through with students. I received this, it was via an email. I emailed out to the class, and a number of people responded. And, you know, it's the typical, Mr. McFarland, we appreciate, you know, I the genuine thought and the preparation that you put into each class. And then I'm going to read a direct quotation from a former student. I had a bonfire tonight with some friends, and we burned all of our homework, but I did keep that one reading that you handed out.
Like, what? I love how that's the, you made it. You're the one that made it.
I am. And it's not even my core. It's not even the sum of the course. It's there's that one reading, and it was saved from the fires of destruction and
the lake of fire.
I am honored that one of the things is going to stick. I'm hesitant to mention, people might want to know what the reading was.
Oh, yeah.
And curious. People might want to know what readings did I hand out that people burned. And there would be a few Twitter handles that I could link up of these authors, and I'm not going to do that. I'll just leave you to think which of the readings, based on what we're doing here, might have been spared the fires of destruction.
Now, here's another one that this may not be a course evaluation, but I think that this is something that's worth sharing of the show. You got to share this message that you received from an alumni.
This is a paraphrase from a student that I talked to just yesterday. They came by my room all excited and said, Mr. McFarland, I was at this preview thing over at Trinity Western University, which is not too far from where we are, and the guy referenced a James K.A. Smith book. And then this student threw up her hands and said, and I actually knew what he was talking about. Which is wonderful. We cited James K.A. Smith in an earlier episode, and it actually was that book, You Are What You Love. I did a whole chapter. I guess I'm going to out myself. I don't think that one survived the purge of that former student. Might have made it into the fires. But this student, it stuck with her, and she actually felt prepared. I felt very affirmed in my reading choice for that course.
That is awesome. Just a message out there. Always recycle your papers. It's much cleaner than doing a bonfire. The recycling bin is ready for you and to get things back and saved to some extent. But I think that's all we really have for today's show. If you enjoyed any of the content, well, first of all, thank you for listening and enjoying what it is that we have to share. Make sure you hit that subscribe button on iTunes or your app of choice, and be sure to give us a good review if you enjoyed what you heard. In addition to that, you can find our contact information. The best way to get in touch with us is on Twitter, and that is through our show Twitter account, which is at Not Many of You. Until then, have a good one. We'll see you next time. Bye.